I was already familiar with the sound that pulled him outside that night, because every city neighborhood develops its own vocabulary of disturbances, the scrape of metal where it should not be, the hollow thud that carries farther than it should, and the sudden sense that something ordinary has slipped out of alignment, which is why when the call reached us later, the sequence mattered more than the noise itself. A man stepping from his home with a firearm because he believed property was being tampered with. A group of youths moving away from him rather than toward him. A decision to fire while that distance was increasing rather than closing. And a body that ended up on the pavement, where no confrontation had actually taken place. Because by the time we began reconstructing the footage, frame by frame, what stood out was not confusion or chaos, but timing. The way choices were made in seconds that could be measured precisely afterward. The way the law asks not what someone felt, but what could be proven. And the way one boy's life ended before any demand, threat, or exchange could even occur. The victim being 13-year-old Karen Blake. I first encountered the case through evidence rather than emotion, which is always how these investigations settle into my hands. Because by the time a detective arrives, the event itself has already passed. And what remains are fragments that must be organized into a sequence that can withstand scrutiny. The neighborhood in Northeast Washington was quiet, in the way residential streets often are just before dawn, with parked cars lining both sides and row houses close enough that sound carries easily from one yard to the next. The call notes indicated that a resident had reported a shooting, and by the time patrol units secured the scene, the focus was already shifting from emergency response to preservation of evidence. The man who fired the weapon was identified quickly because he was still present, and his account was taken early, which meant it would later be compared against physical evidence rather than memory alone. He stated that he believed someone was attempting to steal or tamper with a vehicle on his street, which prompted him to retrieve a firearm from inside his home before stepping outside. That detail mattered, because the timeline established that the weapon was not already in his possession, but was obtained after he perceived a possible crime. A choice that would later be evaluated against the standard of reasonable response. The victim, Karen Blake, was 13 years old, and he was not alone that night, which became clear once surveillance footage from nearby homes and buildings was collected. He and two other youths were seen near parked cars shortly before the shooting, and the video showed them moving away from the shooter rather than advancing toward him. That movement would become central to the case. Because self-defense claims depend heavily on proximity and perceived threat, both of which can be tested against recorded evidence. As investigators, we began by mapping out the physical environment, measuring distances, identifying lines of sight, and determining where each person was positioned and recognized second statements. I studied Marquesby's first word, basis. Shell casings were recovered, and their placement aligned with the direction of fire captured on video, which allowed us to establish not only how many shots were fired, but the order in which they occurred. One of the first conclusions reached through this process was that at least one shot was fired toward a vehicle that was already moving away from the shooter, a fact that complicated any assertion that an immediate threat was present. The medical examiner's findings added another layer of certainty, because the wounds sustained by Blake indicated that he had been struck while running away, not while facing the shooter. This was consistent with the video evidence, which showed him fleeing when the shots were fired. The cause of death was ruled a homicide, a classification that does not assign legal guilt, but does establish that the death resulted from the actions of another person, rather than accident or natural causes. Before any charges were filed, the case underwent internal review, as is standard when a fatal shooting occurs. And this process involved comparing the shooter's statements with the physical and digital evidence. Inconsistencies were documented rather than interpreted, because the role of investigators is to present facts, not conclusions. The delay between the incident and the arrest reflected the time required to complete this review, gather expert analysis, and ensure that any charges brought forward would be supported by evidence that could be defended in court. When the arrest finally occurred, it marked a transition from investigation to prosecution. But for us, the work had already shifted toward preparation for trial. Every piece of evidence, from surveillance footage to ballistic analysis, had to be organized into a coherent narrative that explained not just what happened, but how we knew it happened. This was not about telling a story for impact, but about constructing a sequence that could withstand cross-examination and opposing interpretations. What stood out even at this early stage was the absence of escalation from the victim's side, because the footage did not show any attempt to confront, threaten, or engage with a shooter. Instead, it showed retreat, which meant that the legal questions would focus less on intent to harm and more on justification for the use of lethal force. That distinction would guide every subsequent step of the case, from charging decisions to jury instructions. By the time the case moved forward, the facts had already narrowed the range of possible outcomes, because evidence has a way of setting boundaries that emotion cannot cross. A boy was dead, a man had fired the shots, and the circumstances under which those shots were fired were documented in a way that left little room for interpretation once placed under oath. This was the framework within which the trial would unfold, and it was built long before a jury ever entered the room. The heart of the case rested on the surveillance footage, because it provided a continuous, time-stamped record of events that could be replayed without alteration. As investigators, we reviewed that footage repeatedly, slowing it down, freezing frames, and aligning it with audio and ballistic evidence to ensure that our understanding matched what actually occurred. The video showed the shooter exiting his residence with a firearm already drawn, which established that the decision to arm himself preceded any direct interaction with the youths. Moments later, the footage captured three figures near a parked vehicle, and their behavior did not indicate an attempt to confront or surround the shooter. Instead, as soon as he appeared, the figures began to move away, which was consistent across multiple camera angles. One of the key points established was that the shooter fired his weapon after this movement had already begun, meaning the perceived threat, if any, was diminishing rather than increasing. The first shots were directed toward a vehicle that was pulling away from the curb, and this was confirmed by both the video and the placement of shell casings. Ballistic analysis matched the casings to the shooter's firearm, eliminating any question about the source of the shots. The sequence showed that after firing at the vehicle, the shooter continued to fire in the direction of the fleeing youths, striking Blake. From an investigative standpoint, the timing of these shots was critical, because it demonstrated continuity of action rather than a single impulse of discharge. Each shot required a separate trigger pull, which meant the shooter had multiple opportunities to reassess his actions. This detail would later be emphasized in court, not as a moral judgment, but as a factual description of the mechanics involved. Emergency response arrived quickly, but Blake's injuries were severe, and he was pronounced dead after being transported to a hospital. The medical examiner's report confirmed that the wounds were consistent with the trajectory shown on video, reinforcing the conclusion that he was shot from behind while running away. This alignment between medical findings and digital evidence strengthened the case by removing ambiguity about positioning and movement. During interviews, the shooter maintained that he believed he was protecting his property and feared for his safety, but these statements were evaluated against the objective evidence rather than accepted at face value. Investigators documented his account carefully, noting where it aligned with the footage and where it diverged. The divergence, particularly regarding the level of threat posed by the youths, became a focal point in the prosecution's case. As the investigation progressed, additional footage from neighboring properties was collected, creating a more comprehensive view of the street at the time of the shooting. This broader perspective confirmed that no weapons were visible on the youths and that no attempt was made to approach the shooter. The absence of any verbal exchange captured on audio further indicated that the encounter did not escalate through confrontation. When charges were filed, they reflected the evidence rather than public pressure, because the classification of the offense had to match what could be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. The decision to pursue second-degree murder charges initially was based on the intentional use of a firearm resulting in death, with the understanding that a jury would ultimately determine whether lesser-included offenses were more appropriate. At trial, the footage was presented in its entirety, allowing jurors to see the sequence without interruption. Expert witnesses explained the ballistic evidence, the mechanics of the firearm, and the significance of the victim's movement at the time he was shot. The defense argued self-defense, focusing on the shooter's perception of threat, but this argument was constrained by the objective record provided by the video. The jury's role was not to speculate about what might have happened under different circumstances, but to decide whether the shooter's actions were legally justified based on what actually occurred. After deliberation, they rejected the claim of self-defense, finding that the use of deadly force was not warranted under the circumstances shown. The verdict reflected a careful parsing of the charges, resulting in a conviction for voluntary manslaughter and related firearm offenses, rather than the highest charge initially sought. For investigators, the verdict validated the methodical approach taken from the beginning, because the case hinged not on narrative persuasion, but on evidence that spoke for itself. The tape did not interpret events, but it fixed them in time, and that fixation ultimately determined the outcome. After the verdict, the case moved into its final phase, which involved sentencing and the formal closing of investigative files. The shooter was sentenced to a term of incarceration consistent with the jury's findings, bringing legal finality to the proceedings. For us, this stage required ensuring that all evidence was properly archived and that reports accurately reflected the outcome, because the record must remain intact long after public attention fades. The death of Caron Blake was documented not only in court transcripts and police reports, but also in the data that remains attached to the case, from digital evidence logs to forensic analyses. These materials serve a purpose beyond this single investigation, because they become part of the institutional memory that informs future cases involving claims of self-defense and the use of lethal force. One of the enduring aspects of the case is the clarity provided by the surveillance footage, which reduced reliance on conflicting accounts and focused attention on verifiable actions. In many investigations, the absence of such footage leaves room for interpretation that can never be fully resolved. Here, the presence of multiple camera angles created a fixed reference point that anchored every subsequent decision. The legal outcome did not alter the facts established on the night of the shooting, but it did determine how those facts were classified under the law. Voluntary manslaughter, as a conviction, acknowledged that the killing occurred without legal justification, while also distinguishing it from premeditated murder. This distinction mattered within the justice system because it reflected the specific circumstances proven at trial. For investigators, the case reinforced the importance of early evidence preservation and comprehensive documentation. The speed with which footage was collected and analyzed prevented degradation or loss, ensuring that the most critical evidence remained available in its original form. This process was procedural rather than reactive, guided by established protocols rather than the emotional weight of the outcome. The neighborhood where the shooting occurred returned to its routine, as neighborhoods often do, but the record of what happened remains accessible through official channels. The street itself did not change, but its name is now associated with a case that continues to be referenced in discussions of self-defense law and community safety. From an investigative perspective, the conclusion of the case did not signify closure in an emotional sense, because our role is not to process grief, but to establish facts and ensure accountability. The work ended where it was always intended to end, with a verdict supported by evidence and a sentence imposed according to statute. What remains then is not speculation or interpretation, but a documented sequence of events that can be reviewed and understood without embellishment. A man heard a noise, retrieved a firearm, and fired at individuals who were moving away from him. A 13-year-old boy was struck and died from his injuries. Surveillance footage, forensic analysis, and trial proceedings established these facts beyond reasonable dispute. The case now exists as a complete file, closed but not erased, preserved within the system that recorded it. It stands as a factual account of decisions made and consequences imposed, ending not with commentary, but with the certainty of what was proven and the finality of what cannot be undone.